the club, oh yeah.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2 Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
You're listening to the Pandemonium Motto here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
I want to start today with sort of two economic stories that are kind of coming together as one. One I find more interesting, one I find less interesting. The first piece is this issue of inflation and inflation fears, and we again have data which we'll look at that prices went up again in the month of September. The second part of this, I really am kind of struggling to take it totally seriously, although there is an interesting piece to it, which is fears of toy shortages for the Christmas season. Now, the reason I have trouble sort of taking it totally seriously is, given everything that's going on, everything we've had going on with the pandemic, all sorts of different calamities and crises and different things. If there's not every toy available at Christmas, it doesn't strike me as the absolute worst thing in the world. But it's interesting insofar as it relates to the continued supply shortages for a number of different reasons that we've been seeing. So let's start with the inflation piece. Reuters reporting U.S. consumer prices increased solidly in September, poised to rise further in the months ahead amid a surge in the costs of energy products, which would cast doubt on the Federal Reserve's view that high inflation is transitory. This has been the debate. Are we seeing sort of some catch-up inflation relative to the declines due to the 2020 pandemic? Due to the pandemic in 2020, the pandemic's still going on, but due to the effects of the pandemic in 2020, or are we seeing the start of some real inflation? The consumer price index rose 0.4% last month after climbing 0.3% in August, the Labor Department said Wednesday. In the 12 months through September, the CPI increased 5.4% after advancing 5.3% year on year in August. Excluding the volatile food and energy components, the CPI climbed 0.2% after edging up 0.1%. So what if you don't include food and energy, the increase has been very modest. However, food and energy are significant expenses for many households, particularly, you know, one of the things about food and energy, we've talked about this before, but I think it bears repeating. There is a sort of regressive aspect to food and energy spending. And what I mean by that is, if you're really, really rich, you're not necessarily going to be driving that much more. You might have a car that's less energy efficient or one that's more energy efficient. Okay, if you're doing private jet travel, then yes, if you're very rich, you actually are going to spend a lot more on fuel. But in terms of like driving a car or heating your home, yes, if you have a significantly bigger home, you'll pay a lot more to heat it. But relative to your income, relative to your net worth, it's not going to be that much more. So in that sense, energy cost increases, fuel and home heating, electricity for cooling as well, they hit the poor more than they do the rich. Similarly with food. Okay, if you're wealthy, you might buy everything organic at the most expensive grocery store. But just because you make 50 times more than someone else, you're not likely to spend 50 times more on food. So this idea of if we exclude these two categories, energy and food, the increase isn't that much. Well, those are categories that disproportionately affect the middle class, lower middle class, and the poor. Oil prices jumped Monday to the highest level in years. Expensive energy products would add to accelerating wage growth in exerting upward pressure on inflation. The government reported last week that average hourly earnings increased by the most in 7 months on a year-on-year basis because of worker shortages. With the number of people voluntarily quitting jobs at a record high in August, at least 10.4 million unfilled positions, wage inflation is set to rise further. So this is one piece of the story. The other piece, which again, I'm sort of like, okay, I mean, I get it, but it's also, it is what it is. Toy makers warn delays in stocking retail shelves could create a four-month holiday hangover. Power outages in China, a resin shortage, and high labor costs have also strained the supply of goods and increase prices. The blockage of the Suez Canal in March is part of the bottleneck. Some questions about shares, which we don't care that much about. But there may be delays in getting people toys. So what's the big picture here? We may be heading towards real inflation, meaning not just rebound relative as an artifact relative to the pandemic. We said this 6 months ago. We need to continue watching it. Now, there's another piece that's important to understand, which is inflation good or bad? This is sort of like a fundamental question. If you accept, and many of us don't, but if we accept traditional economic thinking based on, at least for now, indefinite growth, you want a little bit of inflation. Why? Some people think, no, you don't want prices going up. You want prices going down. That's good for people. It's good for consumers. Or prices stay the same. People buy stuff because you expect that prices will be a little bit higher in the future. Maybe not consciously, but let me put it a different way. If you're looking for a car, if you're looking for a home, if you're looking for toys, if you expect prices to go down, that would discourage you from buying right now, because if you wait, you can pay less. If everybody did that because they expected prices to be lower in the future, nobody would buy stuff. And this would actually create a deflationary spiral, which could depress wages. It can put small businesses out of business, et cetera. If you have tons of inflation, people just can't afford stuff. Wages don't keep up. People can't afford stuff. So this is where the mentality of you want a little bit of inflation. That's where wage growth comes from, to the extent that we have wage growth. That's where business profit comes from, et cetera. So when we talk about inflation, it's important to understand that traditional economics doesn't say any inflation is bad. In fact, we have a sort of global economy and status quo based on a little bit of inflation. You expect things to be a little more expensive in the future, so you're going to go out and buy them today. And this creates revenues for businesses with which they pay employees, the money with which those employees go and buy things and sort of keep this train going. Now, if you don't believe in unlimited growth, then at some point the paradigm has to shift. But in terms of the immediate impact, we are seeing sectors experience inflation that disproportionately affect the middle class, lower middle class, and the poor. And we'll just have to continue tracking those data. Tax the rich is a popular slogan among the left. Taxing the wealthiest is actually quite well supported by Americans across political parties, although certainly less so by Republicans, although tax the rich is relatively popular overall. But taxing the rich is actually difficult if what we're talking about is collecting taxes from the rich. And what I mean by that is many of the methods proposed to tax the rich either wouldn't really tax the rich because the rich would find ways around them, or they would be completely impractical. So I'll explain. You raise income taxes. You say, we're going to raise that top tax rate of on income from 36 to 39 to 42 to 50 to 60. Okay. Most of the very rich aren't earning their money through income, through wages. So they're not actually going to be impacted by an increase to the top income tax rate. They make a lot of money through capital gains. Okay, well, so then you say, well, let's raise capital gains. The rich making money from dividends and making money from money will have to pay if we increase the capital gains tax rate or tax capital gains as we do income. Okay, well, there's a way around that as well. The rich can choose not to realize the capital gains to avoid those taxes. They can wait around for the next president or the one after that to lower the tax rate on capital gains, or they can create charitable foundations which they control or use other mechanisms. Okay, well, you've got the estate tax for people who die with more than $1 million or $22 million for couples. There we've got them, right? Well, not really, because you can reduce tax liability there as well with all sorts of other mechanisms, including stepped up basis, Delaware dynasty trusts. I could go on and on. As a business owner, you can reduce taxable income by contributing to a defined benefit plan, and then you earn income from the plan, paying taxes on income later when your income may be lower, but reducing income taxes in the immediate. Okay, well, hold on. So then let's do a wealth tax. Let's tax people's assets, even unrealized gains on those assets. I've already explained why I think it's untenable, and some of you disagree with me. Many times for the very wealthy, net worth is tied up either in their business, in physical assets, in accounts receivable, in stocks with unrealized gains, you may not actually have the liquid assets to cover a wealth tax. And then imagine that you pay such a tax on stocks you haven't sold. And then next year, the market crashes and you lose value in those stocks. Are you entitled to a refund on the net worth tax that you paid? As I've said before, I believe it's completely unfeasible. I think there's essentially no chance that what Elizabeth Warren is proposing on a wealth tax passes. And part of what I'm getting to here is something called the dynamic tax model. When you do a tax model and you score it, how much will we collect? You really should do it dynamically, meaning you account for how people's behavior will change based on the tax plan. So I'll give you an example. If right now we say, listen, if you look at people's income right now, if we were to raise the top marginal tax rate from 37% to 45%, we'd collect $200 billion. I'm just making these numbers up. That only holds if we assume nobody changes their behavior. But the truth is, if you announced the tax is changing from 37 to 45%, that top tax rate, many people subject to the top tax rate would reduce their income, take it in stock, deferred compensation, move personal expenses to business expenses, etc. So you need to score these proposals dynamically to account for changes in behavior. And when you do that, you realize that the actual government revenue change from a lot of these proposals is much smaller than what we might immediately imagine. Okay, great. So these are all the problems. How do we actually collect taxes from the rich? I actually don't know. Because just about every individual change that I've read about can at least be partially defeated, somewhat mitigated. And even if not, people always can abandon the U.S. or whatever country has the tax and go elsewhere. Now, it's not that easy to do in the United States. You may have to renounce your citizenship in the United States to avoid taxation in the United States if you're a citizen. But let's talk about what might actually work. My conclusion, after studying this for a very long time, is if you really want to collect taxes from the rich, you and other countries need to basically take an all-of-the-above approach to make it really difficult to avoid taxation. It's not even going to be impossible, but you've got to start calling people's bluff about leaving the country, for example. I think that that's what it would take. So you've got to raise the top marginal tax rate on income. You've got to tax capital gains as income. You've got to eliminate the stepped-up basis for the estate tax. I've talked about it before. I'm not going to explain it in this segment, but I have segments on it. You've got to put in a more aggressive alternative minimum tax for higher earners. You've got to do it all together and say, listen, if you really want to avoid this stuff, you'll have to leave. And maybe other countries will do the same thing, by the way. So then where are you leaving to? And most people aren't actually going to abandon their country, in this case, the United States. And you're going to be able to pick up some taxes from all of these different things. I don't think there's really any other way to reliably collect taxes from the rich. I understand passing policy that targets the rich, but actually collecting is the difficult part. If you have a better idea, let me know, but I think that that's what it would take. Reminder, we are 6 days from the David Pakman Show live town hall. This will be streaming live Tuesday, October 19th. 6 p.m. Eastern. We'll open up the phone lines for a while. We will be streaming live only on the David Pakman Show second channel called Pakman Live. You can find it at youtube.com/Pakman Live. All right, let's keep going on a bunch of different policy things that I've been wanting to talk about and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about today. Let's talk a little bit about Title 42. Title 42 is something that was created under Donald Trump's CDC to very quickly remove people from the United States without actually going through the deportation process under the guise of public health. And numerous legal opinions are that it's being misused or it shouldn't even exist in the first place. But the Joe Biden administration is using Title 42 to remove people as well. And we should be if we were critical of Trump using it, we should be critical of Joe Biden using it as well. So let's look at a relatively recent Time article about this. Biden is expelling immigrants, migrants on COVID-19 grounds, but health experts say that's all wrong. Despite sharp criticism from top officials and allies within the Democratic Party, President Biden is continuing to expel hundreds of thousands of migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border using a specialized public health order that allows officials to circumvent the normal trappings of immigration procedure, including asylum interviews. The Biden administration is defending its controversial use of the order called Title 42, arguing in court that summary expulsions are, quote, necessary due to the ongoing risks of transmission and spread of COVID-19. But a growing cacophony of top public health experts are calling foul. There's no evidence that a policy allowing for mass expulsions prevents the spread of COVID, they argue, and it may in fact have the opposite effect. By rounding up and detaining hundreds of thousands of migrants in large groups, CBP, which does not offer COVID testing for migrants, may actually be stoking the transmission of the disease. Migrants often spend days and weeks in crowded facilities before they are transported and expelled. The Title 42 order fuels the pandemic, says Julia Kohler, assistant professor of pediatrics. It does not promote public health. It is opposing public health. Top Biden administration officials also appear to be distancing themselves from the policy. Alejandro Mayorkas said Title 42, quote, is not an immigration policy that we in this administration would embrace, but we view it as a public health imperative as the CDC has so ordered. Remember, Title 42 was passed by the CDC under Trump. Title 42 was passed in 1944 as part of the Public Health Service Act, but it was used by Trump to expel people without going through the full process of requesting asylum, getting that asylum interview. If it's rejected, going through a deportation. It's basically like a sort of do not pass go, do not collect $200, just a direct expulsion. Under the order, the CDC can temporarily suspend the introduction of persons into the U.S. when the CDC director determines the existence of a communicable disease in a foreign country or place creates a serious danger of the introduction of disease in the U.S. The order has never been used this way before, nor was it intended as an immigration tool. In April of 2020, he wrote, Stanford law professor Lucas Gutentag wrote, never before in over 75 years has it been used as a substitute or mechanism for regulating admission under the immigration laws. This is complicated by the reality that one can, you have to read between the lines, although it's pretty obvious that this was being used by Trump as a way to enforce his immigration policy rather than an actual public health measure. And part of the way we know it is that some of the reading between the lines is obvious because Trump didn't really take the virus seriously. At the same time that he was not talking about masking, pushing back against closures, praising Ron DeSantis for opening Florida early for, I think it was wrestling and UFC or whatever the case was, Trump was using Title 42 to justify direct expulsions, circumventing the actual asylum and deportation process on the basis of public health. So it was very transparent that Donald Trump was using this without actually caring about the public health piece and just saying, hey, here's a great way to get people directly out of the country. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has been doing the exact same thing. I think that there are sort of two issues here. Does it work to stop the spread of COVID? And is it morally the right thing to do? I think the answer is no on both. In terms of does it help stop the spread of COVID, as many health experts have weighed in, including the ones I just quoted, it doesn't seem to. You are, even though the premise is direct and rapid expulsion, it still takes weeks, if not months. And during that time, folks are crowded together without being tested for COVID. You may actually be spreading COVID by using this policy. That's number one. Number two, what about morally? I think it doesn't pass the moral test either. We should actually adjudicate asylum requests, et cetera, in the proper normal channels, period. And while we were critical of the Trump administration for doing this, we must be critical of the Biden administration for doing it. I think it's wrong either way. I don't care if it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. If you disagree with me, if you think it's okay to be using Title 42 on this basis, then I want to hear from you. This is an absolutely wacky story. We have now learned that Donald Trump was going to appoint his daughter, Ivanka, to be president of the World Bank until Steven Mnuchin intervened. There are a number of reports explaining that back in 2019, Donald Trump told The Atlantic about all the jobs that he wanted to give his daughter Ivanka, even ones where she wouldn't be qualified for an internship. And we have learned, per The Intercept, that the idea was, what about Ivanka as president of the World Bank? In January of 2019, you might remember that Jim Yong Kim announced he would be stepping down from his role as president of the World Bank, going to a very cushy gig on Wall Street at a private equity firm. As the White House moved to select its new leader, one name very dear to Trump's heart kept floating around, his daughter Ivanka. It never came to fruition, with Ivanka later telling reporters that though her father raised the subject, she declined to pursue it because she was happy with her work as senior advisor. But two sources not authorized to speak publicly tell The Intercept that it went well beyond Beltway chatter. Trump wanted Ivanka as World Bank president, but it was Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin who blocked her getting into that role. Spokespeople for Mnuchin and Ivanka didn't respond to The Intercept's request for comment, neither did the World Bank or the Trump Organization. She didn't end up doing it, but she did end up helping Steven Mnuchin and then Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney to choose the successor. How can anyone seriously talk about Hunter Biden when these are the things that Donald Trump was thinking of doing? And to some degree, he was actually doing these things. I mean, remember, I think, was it the G20 or the G8? G8, I believe. Ivanka sat in for then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at a G8 meeting. That's insane. Remembered the cringeworthy video where Ivanka awkwardly sidled up to this conversation with the chair of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and British Prime Minister Theresa May, and French President Emmanuel Macron at the G20. And everybody just looked kind of uncomfortably and said, what the, what? Why is Ivanka here? Lagarde in particular seemed disgusted by it. And it makes no sense that Ivanka would even be considered for such a role. The depths of corruption and nepotism and the self-serving instincts of the Trump family really know no bounds. And for me, the only it's not surprising Trump thought of this. It's not surprising he wanted to do it. The only surprising thing to me is that Trump allowed himself to be talked out of it by Steven Mnuchin. When Steven Mnuchin is the voice of reason, you know you must be coming up with a really bad idea. And truly, I mean, as far as Mnuchin is concerned, I've always seen Mnuchin more as an opportunist. The guy is not dumb at all. He's just an opportunistic finance guy, socially awkward, strange delivery, willing to work for Trump for what he saw as his own personal gain, for which he deserves criticism for sure. But by the standards of kind of like modern education and what's appropriate, et cetera, Steven Mnuchin, pretty smart guy, and it's not a surprise that Mnuchin realized the absurdity of what Donald Trump was thinking here. But the nepotistic instincts of Trump really know no bounds. And when we consider, particularly in the context of it, Hunter is the problem. The problem is Hunter Biden. And then we see, I mean, listen, Kushner and Ivanka were senior advisors to Trump. Imagine for a moment if Joe Biden announced that Hunter Biden was going to become his senior advisor. Or, I mean, imagine for a second if at a G8, instead of the actual Secretary of State, there was video and there were pictures released of Hunter Biden sitting there where the Secretary of State is actually supposed to be sitting. It would be, what, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? They did 7 to 10 days on Dr. Seuss on Fox News. Just imagine. And Trump wanted Ivanka as president of the World Bank. And if he comes back in 2024, I'm telling you right now, the degree to which the nepotism and the self-serving and the corruption will increase is inconceivable to us. It will be insane if he is rewarded with a second term, what we will see in terms of the nepotism. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But very good reporting there from The Intercept and Vanity Fair and others. We'll have more on this on the David Pakman Show Instagram. You can find us on Instagram at David Pakman Show. You can find me on Instagram at David.Pakman as well. So we spoke yesterday about the sort of disturbing reality that at this late stage in the game, you still see most prominent Republicans quite fervently, feverently, and feverishly behind Donald Trump. We had this rally in Iowa over the weekend. Chuck Grassley was there saying Trump's great, all this different stuff. It's very, very concerning. And one of the ways in which Republicans signal their, at least for now, continued public loyalty to Trump, whatever they believe privately. They may hate the guy privately, think he's terrible for the Republican Party, whatever, right? But the way you signal that at least publicly you're still behind Trump is when you're asked, did Donald Trump have the election stolen from him? You don't say no. You come up with anything you can to avoid saying no. And that's exactly what radical bomb-throwing Republican Congressman Steve Scalise did over the weekend when he was interviewed by Chris Wallace. Now, it took me a couple days to get to this. We were off Monday for the federal holiday, and I didn't have time yesterday, but I want to get to it today. It happened on Sunday. Chris Wallace just keeps asking Steve Scalise, was the election stolen from Donald Trump, or will you say that it was not, that Joe Biden simply won? And Steve Scalise goes through every single iteration of how you don't say no. So let's just jump into it. We'll go through these examples and we'll talk about them. And it's interesting to see how Chris Wallace handles it. But really, for me, the more interesting part is to analyze the language that Scalise uses to answer questions that aren't the ones being asked in order to avoid simply saying it wasn't stolen from Donald Trump. Let's jump in.
U.S. Capitol. Let me ask you one last question in this regard. Clearly, there were irregularities in the last election. There are irregularities in all elections. But I want to ask you a specific question. Do you think the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump?
And to be, I'm going to try not to jump in all the time. The way I've been saying this is, anecdotal irregularities aside, which there would always be in an election in a country of 330 million people, do we have any evidence that the irregularities in even one state rose to the level of being materially substantive as far as who the winner was? That's the core.
And in continuing to make that charge, not having states do election reforms, but specifically making this charge that the election was stolen, do you think that that hurts, undermines American democracy?
Well, Chris, I've been very clear from the beginning. If you look at a number of states, they didn't follow their state-passed laws that govern the election for president. That is what the United States Constitution says.
Now, that's absurd. Think about even what Steve Scalise says there. States didn't follow their own rules, which is a matter of the U.S. Constitution. No, it's not. It's quite literally a matter of the state rules. It's not a U.S. constitutional issue. This is backwards and sideways and nonsense. Now, the other issue is, if states didn't follow their own rules, would that be a reason to give that state to Trump? Is that evidence that Trump actually won a state in which the, quote, rules weren't followed? So first you have to prove that, then you have to prove it's materially substantive, then you have to prove that it would have made the election go a different way. If there were people who voted absentee and then moved and then didn't call and say, I no longer live in the state, that may be something that took place, it may not. But then to say, and that means Trump should have won the state, is not backed by the evidence.
They don't say that the states determine what the rules are. They say the state legislatures determine the rules.
But the states all certified.
They didn't follow those state legislative
rules. The states all certified.
Follow those legislative rules. Right, but at the end of the day, are we going to follow what the Constitution says or not? I hope we get back to what the Constitution says.
And remember, this is not about the U.S. It just is not about the U.S. Constitution. He's talking about state rules, state certification.
But clearly in a number of states, they didn't follow those legislatively
set
rules.
So you think the election was stolen?
What I said is there are states that didn't follow their legislatively set rules. That's what the United States Constitution says.
And so then
I think there are a lot of people that want us to get back to what the Constitution says we should be doing, not just with elections, with a lot of other things too.
This is where Trumpists end up repeating they ignored the Constitution in the 2020 election, because they hear people like Steve Scalise say it without explaining it. And they just go, yeah, I don't know.
And then there's some people that want to just ignore what the Constitution says and do their own thing. You know, that's been a debate that's been going on in this country for a long time.
But
why don't we just get back to the Constitution?
I wouldn't have that problem. And there certainly can happen. But there
understand that getting back to the Constitution is different than did Trump have the election stolen from him and was he the rightful winner? Two totally different things.
Out there, there was a rally for President Trump yesterday, and a number of people said, Joe Biden's not my president. Donald Trump is my president. I guess the question is, do you think the election, last time, I promise, do you think the election was stolen or not? I understand you think there were irregularities and things that need to be fixed. Do you think the election was stolen?
Yeah. And it's not just irregular. It's states that did not follow the laws set which the Constitution.
You guys think he'll answer this time? What do you think?
Says they're supposed to follow. When you see states like Georgia cleaning up some of the mess and people calling that Jim Crow law, that's a flat out lie. I think most people need to stand up against that sort of thing.
All right.
Yeah, but the law says, again, that
guys, he's not going to answer the question. He's not going to answer the question. This is how you play coy and avoid the wrath of Trump supporters and avoid the wrath of Trump himself. I don't think there's really any way that Steve Scalise believes this crap in any literal sense. I don't think Steve Scalise believes Donald Trump actually won the election. I just don't think so. And Adam Kinzinger and others have said almost no Republicans believe that. Maybe a couple. I think, you know, maybe Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know. But there is just no way that Steve Scalise believes that, but he doesn't want the wrath of Trump supporters or Trump. He's signaling his loyalty. They see this as a war, as I've said before, where maybe you've got a lie or maybe you've got a claim to believe something you don't really believe or whatever the case may be. This was four attempts by Chris Wallace to just get a simple answer. And the whole point is not answering is how you prove your loyalty. Not answering is how you prove your loyalty. And Steve Scalise is doing it, and we'll see how long they keep doing it. It appears as though it's going to be for quite some time. Okay, I want to talk next about the party that claims to support our police. We must never defund. We must never restrict. We must never limit the techniques and tools and tactics that police are able to use. And yet, they have been persistently and consistently attacking the officers that were there trying to defend the Capitol on January 6th of this year, the day of the Trump riots. We're going to look at a clip today of Newsmax host Greg Kelly calling the police officers who testified at those hearings about the Trump riots, quote, crisis actors. Now, we even have to talk about that term, crisis actors. Crisis actors is a term that in sort of general popular culture, to the extent that it's a term people are even familiar with, was kind of popularized by extreme conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones. I think my first introduction to the term crisis actor was when Alex Jones alleged that the parents of the victims of the shooting at Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut, Newtown, I always forget how it's spelled and pronounced opposite, under Barack Obama, that they were crisis actors. They weren't really the parents of the victims, or there weren't really victims and these were whatever. That's my first real exposure to the term crisis actors. And in this segment, Greg Kelly uses the term to refer to the police officers. Now, remember, Greg Kelly and Republicans, they support the police and all of that stuff. Okay, let's take a listen.
As for Trump, you know where he was on January 6th? He gave that speech. I always said he had a great alibi. I mean, number one, he's not at the Capitol. And number two, he specifically told people to keep it peaceful, right?
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard.
Now, anybody who doesn't realize Trump's talking in code to his followers, you've got to understand the way dog whistles work. But that's not even the focus of this segment.
All right. So I'm not a lawyer, but here's what I would do.
We know.
I would print off a picture of those four police officers at the hearing a couple of months ago. These guys, some people call them crisis actors. I think that was a pretty apt description.
Wow.
Totally unprofessional. This is a law enforcement more than a political question about January 6th, in my opinion, a security matter. But I would not want to go in front of this phony baloney committee. And by phony baloney, I mean this is phony baloney.
Think about what you have to believe in order to follow these people in any real way, right? The world is just full of crisis actors and of false flags. The Sandy Hook shooting years ago, they say that was a false flag. With crisis actors, the impetus was to take people's guns, which, by the way, didn't happen. Record gun sales, weren't even able to pass universal background checks after Sandy Hook. The January 6th riots, that was a false flag by Antifa or liberals to make Trumpists look bad. But it was also peaceful Trumpists. That conflicts. They don't care. It was a false flag. The police officers who were hurt, scared, abused, they are crisis actors also to make Trumpists look bad. But consider what that even means. Crisis actor. The police officers were crisis actors. Does that mean they're not really police officers? Or they are, but they're lying about what happened? Or the videos depicting what happened were staged? Like, what does it even mean to say that the police officers are crisis actors? It doesn't matter. The government that supposedly is in charge really isn't in charge is the basis for a lot of this. We talked about that shadow government conspiracy yesterday. It's a kind of package of conspiracy theories. Sometimes it's called deep state. Sometimes it's trilateral commission, Illuminati, the Bilderbergs, the Jews, the Vatican, whoever. They're really in charge, not the president and the vice president and the normal centers of power. Once you buy into that general idea, it's very easy to be convinced or tricked into believing that the so-called police officers were crisis actors. They were hired. It was staged in some way, shape, or form. And what's kind of notable about this is they don't even realize that they are playing right into the propaganda of foreign nations when they promote this stuff, including Russia's disinformation campaigns. The centers of this type of conspiracy in the U.S. right now are right-wing evangelicals love and spread this stuff. Older white Republicans love and spread this stuff. Authoritarians, just kind of like fascist dictator wannabe authoritarian types. Right-wing media like Fox, Newsmax, OAN, although there are some of the Republicans who don't subscribe to this stuff. But this is exactly the type of stuff that Russia works to spread. The U.S. isn't really in control. The U.S. is being controlled by someone else. You can't trust American democracy. Democracy has failed. You can't trust the election results. This is the Putin-Russia game. They don't even realize that they're playing right into it. Out of one side of their mouth, they say, Russiagate. It was fake. It was trumped up. It was Rachel Maddow and whoever. But at the same time, they're spreading the exact stuff that the Russian disinformation propaganda campaigns want to spread. And if there's really a crisis actor, isn't it the people on Newsmax pretending to be news people? Like, that's really the acting that's going on. And sadly, it's tricking a lot of people. A lot of people are falling for it. And they're not even questioning it in any serious way. So this is the latest. Now, the police officers who they claim to support are the crisis actors. And then just like as a final point, which it must be made anytime we talk about right-wing conspiracies about either the military or the police, law enforcement, etc. They have the stated principle that they support the troops and they support the police, etc. It's not really a principle they abide by. They abandon it as soon as it's inconvenient to support the police or support the troops. In this case, if they support the police, they're supporting these officers saying it was a Trumpist violent madhouse. Doesn't work. So the principle gets abandoned immediately. They don't actually care about the principles. All right. So we can say a lot of different things about Steve Bannon, a former Breitbart propagandist, a former Trump advisor. We can say he's an immoral person. We can say he's a disgusting individual. We can say his politics are all wrong. And all of those things would be true. But Steve Bannon is not a stupid guy when it just comes to basic fundamental statements about how elections work, for example. And that's why I'm not fully getting why Steve Bannon is continuing to say that any day now, Donald Trump is going to be back in the White House. And in fact, on his recent program, The War Room on Real America's Voice, Steve Bannon said Trump's going to be back in 2022 or maybe even before. Now, of course, Donald Trump is not going to be back as president in 2022 or maybe even before. And I know that Steve Bannon knows that. So why is he saying it? Let's consider that as we watch this clip. Take a look at this.
The quiet part out loud today, the anxiety, the hangry, the pearl-clutching is the Democratic Party's fear of the return of Trump. That's what all these committees are. That's what they're trying to do. That's what this all the Justice Department's this, the Senate that, Dick Durbin's got the long face. The return of Trump. And it ain't going to be in 2024. It's going to be in 2022 or maybe before as we start the decertification process out in Arizona. Let the American
people. There is no such process. Okay. Now, I know Steve Bannon doesn't believe that. He just, there's no way he's, we can make a lot of criticisms of him, but he doesn't believe that. So is this the same as when Steve Scalise won't answer when Chris Wallace asks him again and again and again? Was the election stolen from Trump? And Steve Scalise answers every question other than the one that's actually being asked. Is it Steve Bannon signaling? I don't know, because Steve Bannon doesn't need Trump support to be reelected, for example. Steve Bannon is not in the same position. So why is Steve Bannon saying this? Now, as far as the facts, remember that there's no mechanism that makes this possible. There's no, you know, the line of succession is Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi. No one is doubting, I mean, maybe they are, but it's not part of the story that Nancy Pelosi's election in 2020 was also fraudulent. Nancy Pelosi is duly elected. So if by some unknown means that we don't even know, you get the presidential election thrown out, Nancy Pelosi becomes president. It's not Donald Trump. The Supreme Court will not be reinstating Donald Trump. No one will be reinstating Donald Trump. I know Steve Bannon knows this. Horrible person, but he's not this stupid. So why is he saying it? Maybe he wants clicks and this gets him clicks. I don't know. Maybe it's a signal to people to prepare for another violent coup attempt. Neither is a great scenario. I think the coup is worse from those two options. Simply trying to monetize a dumb audience is one thing, but trying to weaponize that audience into attempting another riot, I think is far worse. Quite frankly, it's not like there have really been major consequences, at least yet, for the rioters. So why wouldn't you go for another coup attempt if Steve Bannon tells you that maybe it'll work? Also on decertifying Arizona, whenever you run out of ideas or your ideas are totally rejected by reality, what they do is they come up with a new word that people don't yet know much about. So they think maybe that could happen. The new word is decertification of Arizona. Will never happen. It's not a thing. And remember that even if it did, even if decertifying the Arizona results of the 2020 election in what is almost 2022 now, even if they came up with a way to do it, flipping Arizona from Trump to Biden doesn't change who won in 2020 anyway. Arizona's 11 electoral votes, Joe Biden had 306. You need 270 to win. Without Arizona, Biden still has 295. So it's a layer of nonsense upon layer of nonsense, and people fall for it. And whether the point is money or it's to prepare people to get violent again the next time that this doesn't happen, or it's because Steve Bannon believes he has to do this because it'll help him in some way curry favor with Donald Trump, which maybe he still needs for some reason. I don't know. Whatever the reason, people fall for this stuff, and it's extraordinarily dangerous, and it doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. Before we get to today's voicemail segment, I want to get to a couple of clips of Mike Pillow, as I refer to him, or My Pillow CEO Mike Lindell. The latest conspiracy theory from Mike Lindell, it's idiotic. It's really a doozy, but it's an opportunity to remind people that some much repeated talking points have long been debunked about the 2020 election. We're going to look at starting with this first clip. We have a couple of different clips to look at. In this first clip, Mike Pillow says that an 850-year-old person voted in the 2020 election, as well as 2,000 people who were 200 years of age or older. This is dumb for a few reasons, some of which are obvious, some of which are less obvious. Let's take a listen.
Well, I'm going to give an example today, and I'm not going to say what state. We put from the voter rolls to one of our team. We have a team that goes through all of it now with this other system that pulls up all anomalies. What I mean by that is five people voting from the same address, or five of the same names. I'll give an example today. 2,650 people over the age of 100. Now you might say, "Well, wow, that could be." 2,000 of them were over 200. Wouldn't you like to live in that state? Right.
Tell us what state it is, Mike.
200 and some years old. So obviously they. And one guy was 850.
They were 200 years old. These people that are voting are 200 years old. Of course, they're obviously not living.
They're obviously deceased. But one guy was 850 years old. Okay. And these are facts. You can get them from your own state's thing. Now you have you have non-residents of both,
right.
But basically it pulls out all these deviations, anomalies, and they're stacked up like cordwood. And then we have the canvassing. So then we back it up. So let's say you have an address like we did, like in Wisconsin. Remember where it was 23,000 people.
Yeah, okay. Wisconsin. Imagine having to be the co-host or whatever. And playing along with this stuff, it would be great to know the name of the supposedly 850-year-old person and the state in which they supposedly voted. But sadly, Mike Pillow doesn't give us that information. Now, why does this not make sense? So, of course, it would be fraud. He's not saying there was really an 850-year-old person who voted. He's saying someone who would be 850 years old today is registered as having voted, even though we're not aware of people living to 850 years old, so clearly it's fraud. I hate to add some facts here, but when an 850-year-old person would have been alive, the United States didn't exist. There were no elections. So how would you register to vote? How did the supposedly 850-year-old person ever register to vote such that they would even have been on voter rolls to begin with when the United States didn't exist when they were still alive? It doesn't make any sense. It's pre-Columbian. Incredible. The next clip is, and he was starting to say this when we paused. In the next clip, Mike Pillow says that 23,000 dead people voted with a specific prison. Everyone used, all 23,000 used the same prison address to vote.
I can read. Logan, if you can pull up, I'm going to show you guys in Wisconsin, just an example, how 23,000 people, General, voted using a prison address and used the same phone number. Now, wow. Those people, and a lot of them were people we turned out as we dove into it. They're not alive anymore. They just used their names, obviously.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they don't live in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So what's the opportunity here? The opportunity is to do a real review of the whole dead people voting thing. This was extensively looked at. We talked about it in the aftermath of the election. Michigan was one place where there were claims, dead voters, all these dead, 10,000 dead people voted. Now I encourage you to check out the BBC article, U.S. Election 2020. The dead voters in Michigan who are still alive. The BBC started with the 10,000 names posted to Twitter, supposedly dead people who voted. And they started investigating some of those. And what they found was that this was essentially a combination of people who were just still alive. The BBC picked 31 of the people. 31. And they did 30 names and then added the oldest person on the list. Of the 31 names, people supposedly dead, BBC spoke to 11 or to a family member who said, no, I'm still alive. They are still alive. For 17 others, there simply was no record of their death at all, and they found evidence that they were alive after the alleged date of death. Three people on the list were dead, and they looked at those later. I believe they died after casting their absentee ballot. And then in some cases, it was a question of like junior, senior confusion. So this has been widely, widely debunked, and it resurfaces in different forms. Now it's the names of 23,000 dead people were registered as being at a prison and then voted from there. Why would anyone do that? Why would, if you're looking to vote in the names of 23,000 dead people, why would you say all of their addresses are a prison? That would be, that would call attention to what you're doing. You have to believe that the people who, quote, stole the election are both incredible criminal geniuses in order to pull it off, but at the same time, dumb enough to register 23,000 dead voters at the same address. Just none of it makes sense. And Mike Pillow won't stop. And unfortunately, it's going to be with us for a while. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a doozy of a voicemail from this anti-vaccine woman who keeps calling in. This may actually be the nuttiest anti-vax call we've ever had. Take a listen to this.
Okay. I forgot a word. I remembered it. It's called aspirate. Look up you, Mr. Dr. Pacman.
Why? Remember, I never claim to be a doctor nor to be formulating the things I say about the vaccine on my own. I'm merely reporting on that which we get from epidemiologists, immunologists, public health researchers, etc.
Intramuscular injections require, aspiration. Go ahead and look it up.
Okay.
Look it up in any of your fucking medical journals, Mr. Genius Pacman.
My journals.
This Dr. John Campbell, a doctorate in nursing, is not a fluky kooky.
Yeah, by the way, I mean, without even giving my opinion on John Campbell, I've seen some of his videos. He has an interesting YouTube channel. Some of his videos are interesting to me. Some are less interesting. He has a PhD in health science and like the teaching of health science, and a doctorate in philosophy. So, I mean, it's just, we should just mention he's not a medical doctor. That's not praise or an attack. But even just, you know, Dr. Jill Biden shouldn't be called doctor. You be the judge. You be the judge as to when we should use the term doctor when we're talking about someone who's talking about medicine. I don't know.
No, he's not. There are numerous studies out there. Like you're saying, there aren't any. There's like one study out of wherever. You're so fucking full of shit.
Oof.
It's listed as one of the most essential drugs in the World Health Organization.
Yeah. I think she's talking about ivermectin. And of course, that doesn't mean it works for COVID.
Gets written off label all the time. You know, why would they give a dog the same penicillin that they give a human? Why? You know what? You know what this is all about? This is all about selling vaccinations to people and making billions. We not only paid for the vaccines to be developed, now we got to pay the motherfuckers like big bucks.
Right. So I don't think there's any bringing her back. I just don't think there's any bringing her back. If you think there might be, please explain to me how. On today's bonus show, producer Pat makes his triumphant return. We will hear what he's been up to. We will talk about the resignation of NFL coach John Gruden after homophobic, racist, and misogynistic emails. We will talk about how the New York City schools vaccine mandate is going. And we will talk about the approval by the FDA of another rapid antigen test. What's different about this rapid test for COVID? We will discuss in detail all of those stories on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code BETTER21 to save. If you want, you don't have to. You decide. and we will speak to you on the bonus show.
This is WRCT. This is WRCT. Come on and stay with us a while. Big 900 on your dial. We'll make your day a great big smile. WRCT.
Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Russ.
DJ Haim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any... I mean...
This is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest... academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Yeah, what's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yeah, 88.3.
Check it out, alright?
Word up, real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even know it's a hip-hop show.
Oh, we do. We do everything.
Okay. WRCT Pittsburgh. Music for your inner robot.
You're listening in at your house. Are you listening in at your car? If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabee Selassie.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM. WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz P.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT in Pittsburgh.
O-U-R-C-T, Radio 900.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. Aight, peace.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hi, this is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Rates.
Is Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild!
Oh, it's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
This is Ian McCulloch, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. you're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! At least five people are dead in Beirut after snipers opened fire on a protest. The violence comes as Lebanon faces a devastating economic crisis. Over the weekend, Lebanon fell into darkness for 24 hours after the nation's electric grid collapsed. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Plus, we look at the ongoing probes into Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. The House January 6th committee has subpoenaed former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark days after the Senate revealed Trump directly asked the DOJ 9 times for help to overturn the election.
This president, former President Donald Trump, would have shredded the Constitution to keep his office in the presidency.
And we look at how an Afghan interpreter who helped rescue Joe Biden in 2008 has finally escaped from Afghanistan with his family. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's announced plans to keep the Port of Los Angeles open around the clock in order to battle a global supply chain crisis that's idled container ships off the coast, driving up prices on food, fuel, and consumer goods. The move will double the number of hours the port will remain open to relieve unprecedented supply chain bottlenecks.
This is across-the-board commitment to going to 24/7. This is a big first step in speeding up the movement of materials and goods through our supply chain. But now we need the rest of the private sector chain to step up as well.
The Labor Department reported Wednesday the consumer price index rose by 5.4% in September compared to 1 year prior, partly driven by supply chain problems caused by the pandemic. To keep pace with inflation, the Social Security Administration said Wednesday it would boost benefits by nearly 6% next year. The World Health Organization announced a new expert panel that will investigate the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. The advisory body will include 26 scientists from around the world, including one expert from the U.S. and one from China. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the panel will also investigate the origins of future outbreaks.
The emergence of new viruses with the potential to spark epidemics and pandemics is a fact of nature. And while SARS-CoV-2 is the latest such virus, it will not be the last.
In South Africa, protesters gathered outside the embassies of the United States and several European countries, demanding they break a stalemate at the World Trade Organization and suspend patent rights on COVID vaccines. The so-called TRIPS waiver was first proposed by India and South Africa over a year ago and is primarily opposed by the UK, Germany, and Switzerland. The group MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, which joined the protest, says a handful of European governments with strong ties to pharmaceutical corporations are choosing to put shareholder interests above the lives of people across the globe. MSF added, quote, the U.S. made a big, bold decision to support this groundbreaking TRIPS waiver, but is now largely absent from the global effort to make it a reality, unquote. Meanwhile, a dozen Democratic U.S. lawmakers are calling on the Biden administration to share Moderna's COVID vaccine technology with other countries to expand global vaccine production. The lawmakers note that a contract between Moderna and the federal government grants the U.S. unlimited rights to vaccine data, including all key information needed to produce Moderna's vaccine. The lawmakers add, quote, despite receiving huge sums of public funding from American taxpayers, Moderna has refused calls to share its technology, including from the U.S. government, unquote. The United States reported nearly 1,900 new COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, more than 62,000 people.